Thank you for being here for another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, and I'm very glad to have you with us. You know, it's kind of astonishing to me. I was looking at the calendar this morning, and I realized that today we're ending the 12th week, 12 weeks of doing Political Rewind by remote. I've been saying a long time now that I do it out of my house just outside of the city of Decatur, and then all of our panelists are joining us by phone from across the state, and it's worked out pretty well. I think most people would say to do it this way. We're going to talk about the election today because, of course, we have primaries elections coming up on Tuesday, but we also cannot start the show without talking about the latest in what has been happening in terms of the protests in the streets in cities in Georgia and the efforts that seem to be accelerating to finally address racism and the systemic problems that it has created. We have a long way to go before all that is accomplished, but there seems to be movement in the right direction. But before we get to that, and before I introduce the panel, let me just remind everybody today is the last day of early voting. After this, you've got to vote at the polling place on the 9th or get your, if you've got an absentee ballot. Some of you continue to write me to say you haven't gotten your absentee ballots, which means that you're going to have to go in on Tuesday and invalidate your request for an absentee ballot and then vote at your polling place. Many of you who did early vote this week have also been writing me to say that you thought the procedure was pretty smooth. You felt fairly safe. You felt like there was virus protection in your polling places. But some of you said you waited for as long as 90 minutes or more. So maybe if you can early vote today, it'll be easier than what could happen on Tuesday. All right, let's get right to our show today. We've got a terrific panel to talk about what's happening right now across the state and across the country, as well as look at the election upcoming. Of course, it's Friday. I'm joined by my colleague, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, we see your column on Wednesdays and Sundays, and you oversee the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. How are you holding up, Jim?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Just getting ready for the next Tuesday and the next Monday following that. Tuesday's the primary. The legislature comes back to town.
Yeah, they start coming in, June 15th? And we're going to talk a little bit in a moment about one of the big measures that's expected to be part of their agenda. Dr. Andra Gillespie is with us. She, of course, is a political science professor at Emory University. And her colleague, Dr. Alan Abramowitz, is with us as well. Andra, the last time you were on, I asked you if Emory has made any decisions about fall classes. The answer was not yet. Are you getting any closer?
I guess we are getting closer, but it's still not yet.
You don't know at this point. Alan, you've gotten no word either on whether what kind of classes you're going to be teaching in the fall, remotely or on campus.
I think they've told us they're going to make a decision on June 15th. I believe that's the target date, at least for now.
Okay. Dr. Audrey Haynes is also with us. She's a professor of political science at the University of Georgia. Audrey, the state universities, the effort is going to be made to actually have classes on campus in the fall, right?
We are. Actually, it's been astonishing. We've been getting emails and information about the planning, a lot of changes will be introduced too. And we got an email yesterday saying that there would be 2 masks provided to every single faculty, staff, and student. And I'm assuming the expectation will be that those will be worn when we have our face-to-face classes, and we're doing a lot of class flipping and moving students to larger environments. I've been amazed at the collective effort from the top down to make sure that we do this the right way.
Yeah, I think every school in Georgia is going to be really struggling to make sure they can try to do this right. Jim Galloway, let's start with a column that you just posted at AJC.com. And I want to set it in context, if I may, just briefly. Yesterday in Glynn County, at the Ahmaud Arbery, the first hearing for the three defendants accused in his shooting, we learned from a GBI agent that Travis McMichael, after shooting Arbery three times, yelled at him, spewed at him a profanity, a racist profanity that is just horrifying. And I thought about what it must... I wondered, were these the last words that Ahmaud Arbery heard before he died? And the thought of that is haunting and horrible. That said, at the same time, Jim, the state legislature is trying to figure out, the Senate is, whether or not we're finally going to get a hate crimes bill in Georgia. The House passed it in the 2019 session, sent it to the Senate. The Senate hasn't even taken it up for a first hearing. And you're reporting this morning that its future this session may be in doubt.
Right. I was, if you look at some of the previous statements, say by Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, I talked Thursday to State Senator Brian Strickland of McDonough. You know, they were trying to assure me that they favor a hate crimes bill. They think a hate crimes bill is needed, but they question whether it can be done in the 11 days left to the legislature. Chuck Evstration, he's the Republican in the House who's the author of the bill, says that this search for perfection is nothing but a stalling tactic, that they're out to kill the bill. And what you've seen is, I mean, David Ralston, out of the box after that, the leaked video of the Aubrey slang hit, he called for passage of the bill. Metro Chamber of Commerce, the Georgia Chamber of Commerce have done the same thing. You had the president of the CEO of Coca-Cola North America send a letter to the principals at the state capitol calling for this. That's unusual. You do not calling for the passage of 426. You don't see that very often. So there's a great deal of pressure on the Senate. And I've got to say, by the end of the day, by the time I was nearly finished with the column, I talked with Jeff Duncan's chief of staff, John Porter, who kind of added the element that was missing from Jeff Duncan's previous statements. And he says there will be a hate crimes bill passed before the legislature leaves in June. Duncan presides over the Senate. He doesn't have absolute control over it. So we'll see what happens.
So, Bill, you know, when I think about this bill and I think about what the people are out in the streets for, I think there are some people who think that this is all about being outraged at one man's death, and it's never been about that. It has been about addressing larger systemic issues, and the systemic issues have local manifestations. So there is the larger issue that every community has to deal with respect to police brutality and over-policing in African-American communities. But then there are other structural issues. And so because these two deaths happened and were being discussed at the same time, the Georgia manifestation of this is to deal with something that, you know, most other states have dealt with already, which is to pass hate crimes. And so I think if legislators don't pass this bill, I think some people think that now that, you know, George Floyd is being funeralized, now that all of the officers involved in that case have been arrested, that, like, the protests are going to die down. They're not going to die down in this state. And Jim said this, said as much in his column, right? People are actually going to push for concrete things, and they're going to be diffused and community specific. And for this state, passing a hate crimes bill now is going to be what's going to animate people. And so you either pass it now or you pass it later and expect that there are going to be people who are going to continue to protest and push until this happens.
Alan, before the show went on the air, we were all talking a little bit about this measure, and you pointed out something that we've all watched unfold for quite a few years around a hate crimes bill, and that is that it has stalled in the past, because the legislators who have introduced the language of the bill have wanted to include protections for LGBT individuals, and there's never been any appetite for that in the legislature controlled by Republicans.
Right. I think that that may very well be the big sticking point for many of the Republicans in the state Senate. The inclusion of LGBT people, in this particular legislation, which is the case, I think, in most of the hate crime bills around the nation. But that is something that is a problem for some conservative evangelicals. And, that's a group that is very influential with Republicans.
Audrey?
What I was going to say is that this is an opportunity for the leadership in the Senate, particularly Jeff Duncan and his staff, and the governor as well, to exert a little bit of their political capital to do something that really will be viewed across the state as generally a win. It may not be exactly difficult in some areas, and maybe some of the things Alan says are, roadblocks, but those can be overcome. I think the political cost, if they don't do something like this, is actually going to be worse for them.
Actually, Audrey, you're right, because I've talked to House Republicans who think that if they do not pass this hate crimes bill, they stand in danger of losing control of the House. There's a 16 seat gap there, and you've got a lot of suburban seats at risk. Same thing in the Senate. The good thing about the timing of the legislature coming back is that, of course, it's after the June 9 primary, when most House members won't have the intra-party fights that Republicans pay closest attention to will be over, so I think that does ease a little bit of the angst over taking it up.
Yeah, you're pointing out that perhaps the most conservative members of the legislature on the Republican side, if they're facing primaries, had this come up before the primaries, could have been outflanked to the right and maybe would feel they were in danger of losing their seats if they voted for this, which I think is an interesting. So it's interesting that, in fact, the legislature doesn't convene till after the primary. But, Andre, I want to go to you again. You made an important point. You point out what we've talked about on this show for the past week or so, which is that what's been happening in the streets in the aftermath of Ahmaud Arbery, of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Breonna Taylor in Louisville, we're starting to see that this is about systemic, long-time problems in terms of race in this country. I mean, we're not just starting to see it, but it's becoming more and more apparent. We saw it in the coronavirus, as we see the disproportionate number of African Americans who are struggling with coronavirus. So that's what the work that has to be done, I think. In many ways, the hate crimes bill, it's important because we're one of four states that doesn't have it, but it would be a mistake, I think you would say, to sort of breathe easily if it passes because, well, we've taken care of that problem. Yes?
Well, I think it's low-hanging fruit, and it's the most obvious thing to address in this particular state. But there's still the larger discussion to be had about policing. And so you're still going to see that issue come up in cities and counties around the state over the course of the next couple of years. And also, sad to say, so while I am optimistic by the things that I have seen happen in the last week, I also see places where there's still huge gaps. And I don't think everybody is on the same page about systemic racism. And we heard it from the White House this week with their complete disavowal of the existence of systemic racism. I see undertones of that in the discussion about lynching, in the Senate this week. So I think that there's still some people who recognize, who can all agree that what happened to Ahmaud Arbery and what happened to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor was horrible and that it shouldn't happen. But they don't see it from the perspective of the protesters who have seen most of their adolescent lives, somebody die, somebody die, somebody die, somebody die, and most of the people who did it not actually be punished for it. And they're saying, look, this is actually a pattern that needs to be addressed, and it's the pattern, it's not the individual case. So I still think there's a lot of work to be done there.
Okay. So I was just going to weigh in on what I've been seeing in the public opinion polling on this. And there have been a number of national polls that have been released in the last week or so measuring public reactions to the protests and as well to the broader issue of police brutality. And what's striking in those polls is that there's been a significant shift in public opinion compared with what we've seen in the past, where there is growing recognition that this is a systemic problem, that African-Americans are treated differently, are much more likely to be victimized, and even among white Americans. So that is a big change, and I think that that's part of the context in which these discussions are taking place. And I suspect that that's true in Georgia. I haven't seen polling in Georgia specifically, but you know, I'm pretty sure that that would be the case in Georgia as well. So that is another factor, I think, that is going to influence the decisions that are going to be made when the legislators come back.
So let's Andre mentioned the anti-lynching legislation in the Congress right now. It's, you know, it's really interesting to look at the history of anti-lynching legislation. It was first introduced in the U.S. House in 1918. A Republican representative from Missouri, Leonidas Dyer, sponsored an anti-lynching bill that would have made lynching a federal crime. Almost 100 years late, for 100 years, that bill languished. And finally, a couple years back, both the House and the Senate passed different versions of bills that would, in fact, make lynching once and for all a federal crime. But those bills had different language. They needed to be reconciled. And yesterday, the Senate had an opportunity to approve the final language of the bill, and it turned into an incredibly emotional session on the floor as Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, blocked passage, saying that he thinks that the bill doesn't would be applied to crimes lesser than just lynching, and therefore needs to be improved. Senator Kamala Harris was, and Cory Booker, who were sponsors of the legislation, had emotional exchanges with him. Let's just listen to a little bit of Kamala Harris and Rand Paul.
We must remember the murders of Emmett Till, Raymond Gunn, Sam Hose, and the thousands of others whose lives were destroyed by the barbarity of the lynch mob. But this bill will not do that. This bill would expand the meaning of lynching to include any bodily injury, including a cut, an abrasion, or a bruise.
To suggest that anything short of pulverizing someone so much that the casket would otherwise be closed except for the heroism and courage of Emmett Till's mother, to suggest that lynching would only be a lynching if someone's heart was pulled out and produced and displayed to someone else is ridiculous. On this day, a day that should be a day of national mourning.
So, Jim, of course, Kamala Harris is referring to Emmett Till. The bill in the House was called the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Bill. And of course, we know that Emmett Till's body was so badly battered that his mother was advised that she should have a closed coffin, but she said no. She brought him back to Chicago and wanted an open casket so that people could see exactly what had happened to her son. But the fact that this bill is being held up and that this debate took place on the floor, Jim, yesterday, on the same day that the first service, funeral service for George Floyd was taking place in Minneapolis, is striking contrast.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like it's going to pass. I don't anticipate it that it will, and you don't see persons like Mitch McConnell insisting that it pass. So I think that's quite important. Bill, I just want to add to something that Andra had said about the hate crimes bill being low hanging fruit in Georgia, and she's right about that. And David Ralston, when he says he wants this bill passed quickly and without any amendments, is kind of a signal to Democrats, too, because there are some issues that Democrats would love to address and attach to this bill. And one of them is changing the state stand your ground law, which is, of course, statute was used extensively in defending the killer of Trayvon Martin, and there are the citizens arrest law, which allegedly the McMichaels are using in their defense they've been charged with Aubrey's killing.
All right, so we should point out that. Go ahead, Andra.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree with this, and I will note sort of appended to what Alan earlier said that, you know, in the wake of Ferguson, we also saw this increase in the number of people who were cognizant of the ways that blacks are mistreated by the police. And yes, that is actually evidence of systemic racism. But what I'm talking about is actually a little bit deeper. I think most people get using racial slurs is wrong, killing somebody because of their race. I think police violence that's disproportionate against African Americans is wrong. He detected if I brought up sort of, you know, environmental disparities, if I brought up certain types of, other types of manifestations of inequality, I'm not quite sure that people recognize this. I have survey data that's a little bit dated at this point that I'd love to get back out in the field again that would suggest that it's actually much harder to discern the more subtle forms of racism. And we do actually see differences. And then that's the kind of stuff that ends up being weaponized in debates like this, where people are actually splitting hairs over stupid stuff, as Kamala Harris might say, as opposed to actually getting to the heart of the problem.
So, Andra, let me follow up on that, if I might. And I know we're continuing to go down a road. We want to get over to elections at some point. But mm-hmm. let me ask you this question. As I said a few minutes ago, the spread of the coronavirus, which has shown us the racial disparities in terms of who's getting COVID and who isn't, has highlighted that African Americans are getting at a much faster and bigger rate. And we know that some of that has to do with inequitable health care. It has to do with the jobs that African Americans fill that have put them out in the streets at a time when they can't shelter in place. It has to do with any number of socioeconomic conditions. Is it more likely that if we focus on how the virus has impacted the African-American community rather than, say, police violence, that people may start opening their eyes?
We actually don't know the answer to that question, and it's funny that you ask that. Now, I mean, I think that that's a testable question. For the last couple of weeks, this is kind of grant writing season for a lot of academics. So I and a number of colleagues in different places have spent the last couple of weeks writing rapid grants so that we could get the money to actually test these questions. So we won't know for a little bit till we get money whether or not that's true. I think it's an open question, and we're all very curious to find the answer to that question.
Audrey, you want to jump in?
Yes, to follow up on sort of what we were talking about with those bills, too. The one thing that we should say that is perhaps indicative of some sea change is that both of the bills written in the House and the Senate regarding the anti-lynching laws were bipartisan. And Mitch McConnell still has an opportunity, if he so chooses, to take procedural steps to sort of force a vote, which would sort of, end the activity that Rand Paul has generated. And he has the right to raise those questions if he so chooses in the Senate. It's drawing attention to him, perhaps, that he might not actually want. But I think we'll see. And that is a positive thing, that there is some reaction, even though it's been such a long time coming. And I also think because Republicans have taken on criminal justice reform and tried to co-opt that as something of their own. In fact, Doug Collins was talking about this the other day in reference to something that Kelly Loeffler had put out, where he was saying, you can't call Trump a racist, or because he's the one who is promoting criminal justice reform. So I think there's a lot of struggle in the Republican Party trying to grapple with what's going on and come out somewhere on the other side where they look like they're in better shape for November. And I think it's very difficult for them, especially with the leadership at the top.
Thank you for that. I've got to get to a break in a minute. Before I do, Alan, President Carter issued a statement the other day about police violence against African Americans, excuse me, about the protests in the street. One of the things, Alan, he did was to remind people that when he gave his inaugural speech and he became governor in 1971, he declared the end. He said, now is the time to end racial discrimination. Front page of the New York Times the next morning heralded that as the beginning of the new South, that a Southern white governor would make that kind of statement. And then so Carter said he's saddened by the fact that these many years later, we're still fighting that battle. And he said, since leaving the White House in 1981, Rosalynn and I have strived to advance human rights in countries around the world. We have seen that silence can be as deadly as violence. A people of power, privilege, and moral conscience must stand up and say no more to a racially discriminatory police and justice system, immoral economic disparities between whites and blacks, and government action that undermine our unified government. We are responsible for creating a world of peace and equality for ourselves and future generations. It's a powerful statement, Alan. The question is, have we reached a genuine inflection point? We don't know. Oh, that's a subjective question, but I'd love to know what you think.
Well, I think it's interesting that it's not just President Carter that has made a statement along those lines. Every ex-president has, in the last a week or so, has come out with very strong statements about this issue and they're giving their support to efforts to address the concerns with systemic racism and with police brutality in particular, and that includes President George W. Bush, who put out, I thought, a very strong statement on this, along with President Carter, along with President Obama, along with President Clinton. And so in every case, I mean, the statements, what we've heard from these ex-presidents contrasted markedly with the sort of rhetoric that we've heard from the White House.
And Bill, you have to wonder whether it's kind of purposeful and organized, because of course it was George W. on Monday, Obama on Monday, and then Obama had a town hall on Wednesday, and then Carter's statement came out also on Wednesday, and the very next day you had the Washington Post saying, look, these guys are saying this, and your outlier right now is President Donald Trump.
All right, let's do this. Thank you for that conversation. We've got to get to a break. When we come back, I really do hope you'll all feel okay if we move toward talking a little bit about factors that are weighing into our voting on primary day next Tuesday. We'll do that in a moment. This is Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Dr. Audrey Haynes, Dr. Alan Abramowitz, Dr. Andra Gillespie are with us today, and so is Jim Galloway. Jim and I, we're just sort of ordinary people. You're not a doctor, are you, Galloway?
I'm not a doctor, and my name doesn't start with an A, so I'm not a member of the A-team here.
That's right. Yeah, I'm thrilled. We can't bring back the entire A-team at one time because of the limitations we have in terms of our audio board when we're operating remotely, but we do have three of you here, and it's really wonderful that we do it. And we should point out you're going to be back next Wednesday to talk about the outcome of the election. All right, let's start with this, Jim. We are looking at early voting numbers, and apparently at this point, we have had over 1.1 million people cast ballots in early voting. The numbers, you may have them in front of you, but I think we had a slightly more. Oh, I do have them. 51% of the ballots cast have been Republican, 46% have been Democratic. But this tells us that we are going to expect a big turnout on Tuesday. If a surge of absentee ballots are going to have to be counted as well.
Right. And most importantly is that we don't know who's turning out to vote. All we know is that there's plenty of them. In 2016, the last kind of the last comparable primary, you had the 65% of the ballot casts were Republican. Now, granted, that was Democrats were busy picking a sacrificial lamb to run against Johnny Isaacson, but still, that's a nearly 15-point drop in party identification is a huge shift in Georgia, and I think it really tells us something about what's going to happen in November. I'd love to hear what our political scientists have to say about that.
Yeah, Audrey, why don't you jump in first, and then we'll go around.
Well, that's a very good question that Jim raises. I'm going to be at the polling places on Tuesday collecting data about how people interact with their ballots, so I'll be able to see firsthand who's showing up. But I think there are indications that this election matters, and people see it as mattering. And they also think, and I believe, that their vote will matter. And the choices that they make will have an impact on the election. They're paying attention. I mean, we are in the middle of a pandemic. We're in the middle of a change, being brought about by massive civil activity. So people are voting, and they've been doing it for a while, right? A lot of people have already voted before this last iteration of activity. So it'll be interesting. We may have some data on how votes change dependent on when these ballots have been cast. There's a difference between the early absentee ballots in their direction and people who turn up on Tuesday. So actually, we're living in the middle of what could be a very historic moment in Georgia political history.
Oh, okay. So, all the indications that we have from the polling in Georgia are that when we get to the general election, that we're going to have a competitive election here in Georgia, both for president and for probably both Senate seats. Of course, the jungle primary, kind of hard to know how that's going to play out. But the polling that we've seen recently shows that Trump and Biden are running neck and neck in Georgia, and that Ossoff or any of the Democrats really. Ossoff, Tomlinson, Riggs, Amico are running pretty close to Perdue at this point in the Senate contest, and so I expect to see that continue. I mean, my guess is that we're going to have a close election here, and that Georgia is being increasingly viewed as a swing state. It's not one. I don't think Democrats are necessarily going to put a lot of money and effort into Georgia because that would just be icing on the cake. But I do think we're going, but on the Senate election, certainly winning Georgia would be a big boost to allowing Democrats to take back control of the Senate.
So one of the things that's actually interesting when I'm looking at where absentee ballots have been turned in, I think one of the things that's actually really interesting about the interest in it is that it's actually pretty evenly dispersed across congressional districts. So I expected to see this huge, huge spike in the 6th and the 7th district, and it's bigger in the 6th, but I didn't see the huge spike. So I think that that's a testament to the interest of this election for voters across the state. It doesn't matter whether or not you're in a really competitive congressional district or not. One of the things that I wish we had in this state was same-day voter registration, because I think a big question is for the people who have been out in the streets for the last week, are they going to translate their righteous indignation into voting behavior? And there are people who have gotten activated in the last week who won't be able to participate in this election because they're not registered to vote and because the deadline was a month ago. So, this is why some people want to make voting as proliferate as much as possible, because those are the types of people who you want to be able to challenge their frustrations, in a way that's actually going to be constructive and formal politics.
Right. And in fact, Stacey Abrams actually had an op-ed, and I think it was in the New York Times, about this very issue and about translating the discontent with the status quo into voting. And when to a lot of people, voting might not seem like a very effective way of addressing, at least directly, these kinds of concerns with police brutality and systemic racism. But the point she was making is that it is a very necessary step on the way to addressing those problems by making sure that we have leaders who are going to feel accountable to the people on these issues. So it's too late now, as you said, for people to register to vote for the primary, but it's certainly not, there's still a long time to go before the general election, and I expect that we'll be seeing in coming fall, I think we'll be seeing another election in which voting by mail is going to be the predominant method of voting, and where voters are going to be mailed ballots again, or mailed applications. Despite the fact that the president doesn't seem to like that, I think we're seeing across the country, even in states where you have Republican secretaries of state, as in Georgia, that they are moving in that direction.
You know, Jim, it's interesting. In the 6th and 7th congressional districts are obviously where the most action is in terms of competitive primaries in both the Democratic and the Republican sides. I'd like to focus for a minute on the Republican candidates in the 6th and 7th, Jim, because the messaging from them is has been pretty uniformly consistent. It is, I'm more of a Trumper than my opponents are. I mean, the Republican candidates are positioning themselves as the strongest supporters of President Trump. I get that in a Republican primary. But what's fascinating, Jim, is to think about what happens if President Trump's approval ratings continue to drop. What are the Republicans who win those contests in the 6th and 7th? How are they going to try to wean themselves away a little bit from President Trump? Or are they going to be, we don't know for a fact, but are they likely to remain loyal all the way till November?
That's the problem, isn't it? Because to get out of a primary, you have to be a Trump absolutist. And then once you get out of that primary, the general election dynamics take over, and the climate is going to be a lot harsher. And by the way, it's not just you have hot Republican races in the 6th, the 7th, the 14th, and the 9th, which are all open.
Absolutely,
and those are big contests. But the only race in that we're going to see some finality to is the 6th district, because Karen Handel has been anointed as kind of the choice of House Republican establishment. She's gotten quite a bit of help from them. I would also point to you, Bill, this isn't just about politics. This is Tuesday is going to cap just this tremendous logistical effort. I mean, in January, you know, it was all about, you know, putting a $100 million new voting machine system in 159 counties. Well, in March, we just had to throw that over. And now it's about can counties process and count these million plus absentee ballots they're getting. And we forget, the vote count started last Monday, June 1st. And it will only conclude maybe several days after January, right. June 9th.
Yeah, I wonder, Audrey, when we're, you know, we could be waiting days on some of the closest races for the absentee ballots to be counted. And I'm assuming that even when we get counts in, if there are contests, there are certainly likely to be where few hundred votes, 500 votes, whatever, separate the two candidates at the top or create a runoff or not a runoff in some situations, that we can expect, given the mechanics of this election, to see challenges to results across the board.
We could. And, you know, democracy is messy. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of work. And what a lot of people in the state may not realize is that the Secretary of State's office is relatively small. That when you look at the Board of Election staff, those are relatively small, and they often operate on election day with a host of volunteers. In fact, getting all those mailings out, those were contracted out. There was like some controversy with the sleeves. It's a really tough coordination effort. And counting those ballots and doing so carefully will take time. And we would like to hope that our elected representatives and those engaged in politics will allow that process to take place without introducing controversy that will delegitimize the activities themselves. I mean, I know that the Secretary of State's office is very focused on making sure that it is done right. In fact, the work that we're doing to look at the interaction of people with their ballot is something that they are supporting because they want to make sure that people are checking their ballot and that they do have trust in the system. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right. So following up on that, I think that it's interesting to see the contrast between what our own Secretary of State here, who is a Republican elected official, has been doing. And actually, this has been happening in a number of states across the country. Trying to move very rapidly, actually, toward an election that is going to be based very heavily on mail-in voting and the comments that the president has been making, attacking mail-in voting, attacking absentee voting, inaccurately claiming that states were mailing ballots to everyone when they were not, and essentially trying to raise questions in advance about the legitimacy of the election. It's really quite startling to see the president of the United States seeming to undermine the legitimacy of the election itself and some pushback against that by election officials, including Republican election officials.
Including Republican officials right here in Georgia. Brad Raffensperger has made it clear that he thinks it's important that we have this absentee process, especially during the pandemic. Andre, I want to ask you about a WSB TV poll that looked at the Democratic Senate race number one, where we will have a winner declared if there could be a runoff. But the fact is that's the seat that David Perdue now occupies. So you will vote on Tuesday if you haven't voted already, if you're taking a Democratic ballot for that race. And I point that out because some people have contacted me and asked why they haven't seen names like Raphael Warnock, Kelly Loeffler on the ballots that they got in the mail. It's because those won't be decided until November. Okay, all that said, WSB, Andra says, that John Ossoff, in their polling, which was done by Landmark Communications, has John Ossoff at, I think, at like 43%. Sarah Riggs Amico and Teresa Tomlinson are in the teens. 28% say they are undecided. And I wonder, Andre, what it suggests to me is that, well, I don't know what it suggests to me. Does it suggest that race has been frozen with 28% still undecided? Is that partly because nobody's focusing on electoral politics right now? It's an interesting situation, Andra.
So that 28% is disproportionately young. And so if you look at the numbers kind of broken down by age, Ossoff is generally the leader across all of the demographic categories that were publicized. And it's a more even race amongst the youngest set of voters. And so that group is the one that's most undecided. So Ossoff probably thinks that because he's a near peer, that actually probably bodes well for him. I really wanted to see regional numbers and to see the regional breakdown. What I read into that is two things. One, I read a lot of name recognition into that. And so John Ossoff got a lot of notoriety from running for the 6th District in 2017. And I also think, in particular, his endorsement by John Lewis was actually probably really helpful, particularly amongst African-American voters. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens on Monday.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, sorry.
On Tuesday. A couple things here. Number one, yeah, Bill, I think people have been distracted by the pandemic. I think, you know, Ossoff has had the most money, and so he's been on TV while you've been locked in your house. You know, 1 year ago when this race actually started, I would have said that Teresa Tomlinson probably held the edge. And one thing you do have to acknowledge is that she's run this very smart kind of under the radar campaign reaching out to elected officials outside of Atlanta, outside of Metro Atlanta, and I'm very interested to see how that actually pays off.
Yeah, and she certainly has accumulated a list of endorsements that Andre's right to point out that John Lewis is a big one for Ossoff, but Teresa Tomlinson has accumulated an enormous number of endorsements from high-profile white and African-American Democrats here in Georgia and across the country. So it'll be interesting, as you say, to see how that plays out. It does look like, and we got to get to a break, but I'll give you 1 second on this, Audrey, that Ossoff, at least on the landmark poll, is well under 50%, and so we could see a runoff coming out of Tuesday.
Yes, and Landmark does some good polling. They're fairly strongly, they've done a good job in predicting some of these races' outcomes. But, you know, I would say the one thing that is potentially negative is that, you know, maybe there's a lot of uncertainty. Ossoff may be leading in this poll, and Andre's absolutely right that a lot of it is name recognition. That's always a big thing. But the latest attack on Tomlinson, you know, it could potentially have some negativity for Ossoff among women voters. But it also signals that perhaps he is still worried about her as a challenger. So I noticed that during the debate, she got a lot of attention and a lot of questions from the people participating in the debate, including Ossoff. So she's not out of it, and we may see a runoff. So there you go.
All right. I've got to get to a break. Right now, we'll come back with more on Political Rewind. We've only got a few minutes left on Political Rewind today, but I wanted to get to a story in the New York Times yesterday. Alan, you talked about Georgia being in play in the fall. The New York Times ran a piece. The headline was, Trump campaign looks at electoral map and doesn't like what it sees. And what they're seeing is that swing state, or states that they won and hoped would be in their column in November, Ohio, Arizona, we could name a number of them, look like they could be up for grabs. And so, Alan, the New York Times reports, Georgia is looking more and more like a state the Trump people are going to really want to focus on, especially when you got two important U.S. Senate seats here. Alan?
Right. I mean, there's no question that Georgia is looking like a potential swing state in 2020. You know, every poll I've seen here in the recent weeks has shown that the race is, you know, within a couple of points, one way or the other. So, I mean, some question I think is how much money and effort the Democrats are going to put into the presidential race in Georgia. It's not a state that they need to win, but at the same time, given that there are two Senate races here, maybe we'll see them putting some effort and resources into Georgia. I think as the presidential race goes in Georgia, so will the Senate races. I think it's very unlikely that you're going to see a split outcome between those two. And these Senate elections are becoming increasingly nationalized, and I think that you're going to see that there's going to be very little difference in the results. Although it's possible because of the sort of jungle primary that one may almost certainly will go to a runoff. Given the number of candidates. So that one won't be decided until January.
So it was funny when we were preparing for this, I was thinking about what Alan would say, and I'm not calling this a wave election, but if Trump is in trouble and if he's in that much trouble, then it wouldn't be unusual if Georgia was riding the wave along with other states as well. And so that was what I took from that article.
Bill. Look, I can see the logic of injecting more cash here to save those two Senate seats and preserve Republican control of the Senate. But if you are fighting for Donald Trump to win Georgia, you've got far bigger problems elsewhere. That means you have given up on places like Ohio, on Wisconsin, on Michigan. You're right. If it's even close for Donald Trump in Georgia, that could spell trouble for him.
And let me add too. I think I think that some of our very astute strategic political actors, like a David Perdue himself, who's sitting on a $9 million war chest, if you look at his Twitter feed, it has been focused on the pandemic. It's been focused on policy. Just since the month of May, I have not seen a, oh, that Trump, he's doing great. I got to defend him. I love that guy. So I think they're waiting and watching to see what the political dynamics are going to be heading into this. And Trump always, you know, trips on his own feet. Strong man went and hid in the bunker. Mr. Economy is, you know, the only good thing that may happen is if we rebound, he's going to utilize that. And in terms of blame, he's pointing a finger at Antifa because he realizes that independent voters and even that slim margin of black voters, he needs them desperately in a very competitive election.
All right, just to be sure that we are somewhat balanced here, based on what you just said, Audrey, there are people who would say that there was nothing wrong. Unfortunately, the president wouldn't acknowledge it, with the president being whisked off to a secure location in the White House, that in fact what he should have done was embrace that. He didn't. I just want to make sure we know there are people out there who would argue differently. Andre, you got a couple seconds here to make a point.
I don't care about going to the bunker, but I do care about pushing protesters out of the way so you could have a really weird photo op with a Bible in an offensive way.
Absolutely. All right, Galloway, comments on this show. Brian Kemp continues to say he wants the Republican convention somewhere in Georgia. It's probably not going to be Atlanta if they're even looking at Georgia, because Keisha Lance Bottoms would put up obstacles to that. But it's interesting that they're fighting to see William Pate at the Atlanta Convention, and Visitors Bureau said if the president wants it here, we'll bring it here. We're not going to get the convention.
It looks like the contractual obligations between the RNC and Charlotte are going to hold in large part. You might have an acceptance speech from Donald Trump at a location, and I suppose Keisha Lance Bottoms could throw up some roadblocks. But keep in mind that the Georgia World Congress Center is under state control.
Ah, all right, Jim Galloway, you got the last word in today's show. Dr. Audrey Haynes, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Dr. Alan Abramowitz, and you, my friend, Mr. Galloway, thank you so much for being here. I hope you all have a restful weekend. Please take care and stay healthy. See you on Monday.